Since this is the professional group, talk about some real Buddhism, or not that professional. It's easier for me to talk about something I have interest in and is in my mind at this time. So what I've been contemplating, reflecting upon more recently, since I've been at Birken for the last 2.5 months, I've been working on a certain theme, which sometimes is explained as I'm writing a book. Which didn't happen. But I contemplate a certain theme, and as I'm working on this theme, both researching it in the Pali Canon and reflecting upon it in my own practice, if I make some effort to kind of be a little bit more systematic and make some notes and put it on my computer, sometimes a book happens, but not this time. But at least the notes are still there on my computer, as long as it doesn't crash. Then maybe in the future. But. And also the theme that I was contemplating is one of the most important and profound, and probably one of the most misunderstood aspect of the Buddha's teachings. This is formally in the Pali language, this is called the teaching on anatta. Does that ring any bells? Sometimes translated as non-self or not self or no self. And I think it's a bit of a, while I can recognize that perhaps that translation is very literal, or it's one of the most correct literal translations of this Pali term, anatta, yeah, I think it's very, very, it's fundamentally misleading, because it doesn't clearly represent what the Buddha was getting at. So I hear over the course of traveling around, meeting people have got the impression that you have to get rid of yourself. The Buddha's teaching not self. So you have to get rid of yourself, which is completely misunderstood. Don't get rid of yourself. Beware. Dangerous, dangerous. Get rid of yourself. You need it. And really, the issue is that the self isn't the problem. It's our relationship to it. Yeah. The real issue is the grasping of things that make up what we call a self. It's the grasping the Buddha was pointing at. Because even the fully enlightened being still has a self in a certain sense. But they don't have the grasping of a self. In a formal sense, this is presented in what the Buddha calls the five groups of grasping, the five khandhas, the five aggregates. There are five primary aspects, processes that make up what people tend to identify with as a self. And the fully enlightened being has also those five aspects, but they don't have the grasping. So they have two definitions. There's the Pali is pancha upadana khanda, the five pancha is five. Mitra can correct me, right? Five. Upadana is the grasping, and the khanda is these particular groups. It literally means groups. The five groups of grasping. I translate. Be simple. Well, the fully enlightened being has the five groups, but not the grasping. So, they haven't got rid of their self, you can say, but they have, in order to be enlightened, they have relinquished the grasping of it, the holding of those groups as a self. That holding is identification with them as being me and mine. And yet there still is these five particular processes. One physical, four mental processes that go on. but they are so fundamental to our being, to the nature of a sentient being, that it can be easily mistaken to be something very solid and tangible and permanent. What the Buddha was really saying is there's no such thing as a permanent abiding essence in anything. There's a sabbe dhamma anatta. All dhammas, all things, don't have any permanent abiding essence to them, including yourself, including this body and mind. Nobody's panicked yet? Easy to say, and maybe part of your left brain might even understand it. So I'm impermanent, right? I am getting older, you know. I can give myself that much. I can recognize that much. I'm getting older, but there's something in me which will persist. Huh? My true nature, my true self, or something or other. And maybe some of you, anybody believe in rebirth or transmigration or reincarnation or something or other? And hopefully that essence will come back again, even more intelligent and more beautiful. And hopefully in a heaven realm, so it's even blissful too. However, if you think like that, you know, there is a possibility to come back as a frog. You sort of hit or miss. So it's not always a one-way beautiful street up there, you know. You aren't going up, up, up. And while there is, you know, the principle of karma, and kamma vipaka, doing good actions, you know, they provide for a skillful becoming or a skillful abiding. But you never know what is, you know, back in our minds unconsciously that may also come to fruition. There are stories in the scriptures about some people who were very, very virtuous and very generous and practiced many good things. But when they passed away, they got a very unfortunate rebirth. You know, usually it was very short-lived. You know, just, I mean, maybe the last thought they had was a bit, oh, I made a mistake. And then reborn as a fly for, how long does a fly live? A couple of weeks or so. I think it's more sort of metaphorical, when it's hard to prove. Because I don't speak fly language, so I can't. But while we can understand to a certain degree what the Buddha's talking about, all things are changing, impermanent. But usually we like to apply that, you know, that safe distance, something outside, you know, but not really in here. You know, or just to a certain degree, I hope that my bad things change. But not my good things, not my intelligence doesn't change too much. Yeah, it's always a bit more positive. But what the Buddha was talking about, really, in the Buddha's time, there was this belief in something called the Atman, which maybe we would relate it in Western society to a soul or something. And now I realize that many people don't refer to a soul very much these days. Huh? Anybody believe in a soul? Not so familiar, is it? Huh? So that's why most of the time it's translated as self or non-self. However, that's also usually used, self is usually used in a relative sense, myself. So that's why it can be mistaken, you know, non-self. But I am a self, and I have a direct experience of myself. I mean, I'm not a self. What do you mean? And actually, this Atman wasn't just the relative self of this life. It was that which transmigrated from life to life. So it is more like a soul. But even translating is no soul doesn't quite work either, because the Buddha wasn't denying the self. The Buddha never said there's no self. Is that surprising? The Buddha didn't say there was no self. He said all things are not a permanent abiding essence, or an atman. So he didn't deny it, but he's pointing out that the primary characteristic of this Atman was solidity and permanence. It was a primary essence that persisted. So what the Buddha is talking about is process rather than things, rather than objects. So in the Buddha's time, you can say he had a very different radical experience of reality. And in the Buddha's time, this was quite unheard of, because people were looking at always at objects, looking for a thing, an Atman, an essence. And even today, people are still, our consciousness is still object-orientated. Huh? You look at people, and then a person just takes shape there. And then we hold on to that. And many times the first impressions, you meet a person, the first impressions are very strongly imprinted in your mind. Next time you see them, you're that person who, like this. They've changed. And then they do something different, say, you aren't the same person you were yesterday. Yeah. Well, I mean, they're just the way they are, But you are still holding on to that old image of how they were. You've objectified them, in other words. Whereas, this is what the purpose of, you can say, insight meditation is too, is to be more aware of the present moment, which is just absolutely unique. This moment is absolutely unique. Even you have a memory of yesterday, but even that memory is quite unique. Absolutely unique actually. Not exactly the same as it was what happened yesterday. The memory of it, but it's not completely accurate. Just roughly the same. And the same as the way our mind works. We have a particular tendency to absolutize things, to concretize, to objectify things. It's too hard. The mind isn't prepared yet to deal with constant change. If you came into this room every Sunday and had to reconfigure this room in your mind, but you come in here, it's the same as it was last week. That's easy, isn't it? But it's wrong. Not the same as it was last year, or last week even. Even this last minute. The floor is getting a bit older and getting a bit darker. And I won't talk about your mind. A bit older and a bit weaker and a bit more tired. And so the way the mind works, it needs to affirm a certain stability to its reality. Yeah, so it just glosses over things. Yeah, roughly the same, good enough. But it has changed. But if you had to investigate what's different about it or something, you'd waste so much energy and you'd be so mentally exhausting, you just couldn't do it. Couldn't function, so you just gloss over and say it's good enough, but same as it was last time. But it's a little bit off. It's not quite right. It's not really the way things not the way things really are. Most of the time, it's good enough. But then, when things start to happen, which are unexpected, we know, okay, the body is it's changing all the time and it's impermanent. And my sore knee. That shouldn't be. That doesn't fit my pattern of how it should be. And then we don't adjust to the way things really are. That's why we suffer. Reality is this way, but I think they should be that way. I expect them to be that way, but they're this way. Oops, and we're out of harmony then. And there's friction, there's conflict, disagreement. And that's called suffering. But at least developing the meditation exercises bring us in more and more in harmony, in tune with the way things really are. And more you're able to be in the present moment with the breath, the state changing states of mind, you begin to notice, this mind is changing. Sometimes you can have quite a dramatic insight into impermanence. I suggest when people begin meditation, rather than just take up your old meditation habit posture. Yeah? When you sit down, you sit similar posture, but bring awareness to this body as it is in this moment. Not the same as it was before. You just assume it was, but when you bring awareness to it, you notice some changes maybe. Sometimes, you know, there is a continuity of similarity. But if you look more carefully, closely, you see the differences in that too, the changes in that. It's just an assumption we have, a concept. Our concepts are much more stable than reality is. When you look at the experience directly, the physical sensations, I mentioned on yesterday, the feeling tones and states of mind, when you begin to look at them more carefully in the present moment, you see how they're always changing. And then you have more a direct experience of the change. And within that, I mean, the teaching on non-self, anatta, really was pointing at the most direct way you can see it is through change, through impermanence. Because one of the definitions of Atman or Atta or self was that it was permanent, it was stable, an essence, a primary stable essence that continued through life. It's like our hard drive on our computer. But our brain isn't like that, is it? Hmm. What's your name again? Forgot already. But that's the way it is. That's when you begin to become more in tune with impermanence. And non-self or selflessness is the ultimate reality. This was what the Buddha called the three characteristics: impermanence. Second one, you can gotta be careful with that one too, because that's another, I would say, misleading translation of the word dukkha as suffering. Better, a little bit better is unsatisfactoriness, and then there is impersonal. So there's impermanence. You can say impermanence. Imperfection or unsatisfactoriness, and impersonal, the three I's. Easy to remember. But, you know, even using these concepts, they're just guidelines, like signposts pointing the way. And through meditation practice, so the Buddha was a meditator, not a philosopher, so he was pointing at a direct experience of these. You know, even remind you that things are impermanent. You know? And you know, one example is that, you know, some people know about it intellectually, but then, you know, something breaks and oh, they're surprised. You know, Ajahn Chah once, he gave a talk and he said, you know, he pointed to a glass of water he had there and he said, you know, people don't really understand impermanence. He said, really, if you really understand it, that glass is already broken. Get that? That glass is already broken. But most people, they look at it as impermanent, and then when it breaks, oh yes, right, impermanence. It's a good excuse to, you know, if your cutlery or if your glass breaks, oh well, it's just Buddhist, you know. Impermanent. You broke my glass. No. That's just nature, you know. But Ajahn Chah said, no, the glass is broken already. See? So then when it does break, you say, aha, finally, you've manifested your true nature. So no surprise, it's a celebration. But can you do that? Most people are upset, aren't they? It shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't break. You know? So you're still holding on in your mind that it's permanent, and then if it has to, it'll break. But not on my shift, please. Not on my watch. But if you really understand impermanence, then not surprised. Yeah. Things break. That's because they're naturally, inherently impermanent. Huh? So they're always going to break. That's a hard one, isn't it? That's only the first characteristic. And another, I think another one is the teaching about, in Pali language it's dukkha, the word dukkha. And it's usually translated, I think, again, misleadingly and unfortunately. It's been unfortunate to have that translation as suffering. The Four Noble Truths, there's dukkha, there's a cause and cessation and path. So the Four Noble Truths is suffering. So people hear that and they think Buddhism's pessimistic. Always talking about suffering. And then when Ajahn Sweta went to England, there were many Buddhists there who had read some of the early scriptures about the Buddhist teachings, and they heard about suffering. Maybe they're a little bit, I would say, inclined to appreciate suffering. And they kept talking about suffering. And Ajahn Sweta said, "Hey, the Buddhist teaching is suffering, but the way out is suffering too. Cessation of suffering." Oh yeah, we forgot that. But this word is used in several contexts. That's the trouble, see. And some of the early translators, they wanted to find one English word to translate the Pali word. So they chose suffering. However, it doesn't fit with the Four Noble Truths, because not everything is literally suffering. But it is unsatisfactory, it is imperfect. Everything is imperfect. No perfection in life. Life ends in death, youth ends in old age, health ends in sickness. If you can see the whole picture, then it's perfect. But most of us don't see the whole picture, do we? We look at life, and we look at health, and we look at youth, and the other stuff, not today. we look at, we eat our supper and we feel full and fine, and we don't want to be hungry, do we? The reason you eat is because you are hungry. You need hunger in order to eat. You got to see both sides of the coin, both sides of the picture. There's only daylight when it's dark, but who likes the darkness? Only bats. So we're one-sided. We always look at the positive side, if you like, or pleasant side. Or, I mean, maybe if you're a bit pessimistic or something, rather you look at the other side. But we have imbalance. We don't see the whole picture. So it's really there is imperfection is a fundamental truth of life. Imperfection, incompleteness, and then that causes suffering for most people because they don't accept it. Don't accept the imperfection. We're very idealistic, have all these positive ideals, but many times they don't live up. Reality doesn't live up to it. But one time Ajahn Chah said in Thai, I've pressed it from Thai now. He said, I got maybe I have to say it in Thai first, then I got to translate. The word dukkha in Thai is tuk. So he said, tuk bentuk, but suk bentuk. So suffering or pain is dukkha, and happiness is sukha. Sukha dukkha. Nice little rhyme there. I can make a poem some more time. But he said, he basically saying, suffering is suffering, got that. Happiness is suffering, haven't got that. But what he was saying is suffering is unsatisfactory, is imperfect, and happiness is imperfect too. Got that yet? You say it easier in Thai. And if you were to say, "Oh, happiness is suffering," or "happiness is imperfect," don't like that. Happiness is the meaning of life, right? Purpose of life, happiness. But how long can you be happy? Even if you were able to turn on your happiness gene or whatever, it would still, you get bored with it. Yeah. After a while, you die of pleasure boredom. The reason that you recognize pleasure is because there is the suffering sometimes. You know, the reason you appreciate eating is because you're hungry sometimes. If you could eat whenever you wanted to, you probably wouldn't appreciate it. That's the nature of the human condition. Too much of a good thing is painful. And then the teaching on non-self is really pointing out, like, it translated as the impersonal, you know, we are fundamentally, we need to find some point of reference. So that's why we develop a self. You know. So we have a set point of reference. Then we start to believe it as being an absolute. And yet if you look more closely, I mean, what do you identify with as being yourself, kind of at the basic? Huh? Is it your body?
We're too old for that, aren't we?
Of these five, there's four mental ones. One is, the first one is feeling tone. Are you your feelings? You see quite a variety of feelings just in a short time, can't you? Feeling, you know, pleasant feeling tone, not unpleasant feeling tone. So it's not very stable, is it? So you identify with feeling, boy, you're all over the place. I got three selves now. I got a pleasant self, an unpleasant self, and a neutral self. Take turns wearing the hat, you see. How about perception? Or perception, more properly, would say, is memory. We're able to perceive because we have a frame of reference like memories to associate. It's associated knowledge, sanya. But are you your memory? I think we're too old for that one too, aren't we? If I'm my memory, I've lost a lot of weight. Okay, running out of options here. The fourth one is literally mental activity, mental processes, a variety of mental processes. Are you your thought processes? Of course, this is a professional group, so you probably noticed already in meditation. You know, can you control your thought processes? Huh? Can you turn them on and off and say, happy thought? Where's that happy thought? Where's it go now? Can you control your thoughts? Huh? The fourth one is consciousness. And the Buddha, some people, they probably identify, I think philosophically many people identify consciousness as something which is very permanent. You know, you are consciousness. And in the Hindu tradition, I don't know if I can, this is a yoga studio, isn't it? There, the Atman was defined as Sat, Chit, Ananda. Sat was being, Chit is sometimes translated as consciousness, Ananda was bliss. These are permanent things that identify this Atman with consciousness. That's what transmigrated, some kind of consciousness. And this was also, it's also a little bit filtered into the Theravada tradition too. In the Abhidhamma, they talk about it as consciousness. It's the relinking consciousness which stimulates the next life, you see. And so sometimes a little bit of soul theory creeps into it, but the Buddha defined consciousness as consciousness of things. So you need something to be conscious of. It's not a thing in itself. It's a mental process, an incomplete process, so you can only be conscious of something. And some things are always changing. So consciousness is always changing too. You might get a little bit of an impression of it if you recognize consciousness is like more like your state of mind. Not the mental activity, not the contents, not what you're thinking about. But notice your state of mind. Is it uplifted? Is it depressed? That's a little bit more like consciousness. See, when your mind is expansive, you have expanded consciousness. You're conscious of more things, or things at a higher level of consciousness. rather than the content of your mind. That's the sankhara, that's what you're thinking of. I'm conscious of what I have to do tomorrow. I'm conscious of plans of the future. That's the content, that's the mental activity. But it's just always changing, right? You can have thoughts about tomorrow, thoughts about next week. That's always changing. But what about that quality of knowing what you're thinking about? Well, it's if you look closely, it's changing too. Sometimes it's clear, sometimes it's fuzzy, sometimes it feels uplifted and expansive, sometimes it's, I can't think very straight, I can't see what I'm thinking of actually. So if you look at these, the Buddha, probably one of his simplest teachings, the quickest way to enlightenment. Are you waiting? Might take me a while to explain it. Is to contemplate the change in these five particular groups of grasping. So you contemplate them rising and falling, passing away, coming and going. And, this is what we identify with as ourself. It's more like, it's a bit abstract to say, oh, just notice your changing self. But what I mean, myself? Who's myself? But it's a bit more practical and said you identify with these five things, primary things. That's what you take to be yourself. So that's a bit more clear, isn't it? If I just say, be aware of your changing self, a bit vague, isn't it? But be aware of your changing body, be aware of your changing feelings, be aware of your changing memory, be aware of your changing thought processes, mental activity, be aware of your changing consciousness. Isn't that a little more clear? More direct, or what, is a bit more clear about what it is that we're observing the change of. But that was one of the simplest teachings the Buddha gave. When somebody asks for a simple, brief teaching on Dhamma practice, so they can go off and meditate in the forest and get enlightened. He said, if you contemplate the rise and fall of these five groups of grasping, it's the quickest, easiest, or most succinct way to realize awakening. So, you got it. Waiting. <Anybody? laughs> The quickest way. Unfortunately, many people don't know this. Maybe if you do, you have developed some awareness within in the context of the four foundations or bases of mindfulness, body, feeling tone, states of mind, and the Dhammas. There's already three of these five aggregates right there. I mentioned yesterday a little bit more detail about, the body and then feeling tones, states of mind. This is a mixture of sankhara, the mental processes, consciousness, you could say, and maybe memory too, maybe sanya, perception. And in the Dhammas, the fourth of the categories of mindfulness, these five groups of grasping are specifically mentioned as a theme to contemplate, investigate. There's the six senses, the five aggregates, the factors of awakening, the hindrances, and the Four Noble Truths, five different groups. But usually, for myself, I didn't know much about these categories. When you talk about the self, I don't think of feeling, perception, sankharas, consciousness. I just think, myself. Yes, what is that? Very, very vague and abstract, but. Yeah, but if you get a little bit more specific about them, and maybe we have to learn about them, study them, learn about them, to be able to distinguish what these are as aspects of our experience. Because the Buddha is saying they're happening all the time. There's consciousness, mental activity, perception, feeling tones going on all the time. But are you aware of it? So in the development of the exercise in mindfulness, the Buddha points out, feeling tone. Give particular attention to it. Develop mindfulness around feeling tone. About states of mind. States of mind are closer to the sankharas, the mental contents, you see. But there is also whether the mind is uplifted or depressed, expansive, expanded or contracted. Those are states of mind to be aware of too, of mindfulness, whether the mind is concentrated or not. Then you get a little bit more insight into consciousness. Consciousness is a type of knowing, a knowing principle. So how is your faculty of knowing? Expansive, contracted? That's consciousness. So when you begin to become more aware of them, then you get them in the context of now this is the five groups of grasping here. And behind it, besides them, you notice, you can see you're reaching out to them. Yeah. My feeling, you know, especially when it's pleasant feeling. Huh? Can you see the grasping of that? Pleasant feeling? Yeah. Pleasant feeling tone? Yeah, I'll take that one. Unpleasant feeling tone? No thanks. But even pushing away, see, pushing away, like unpleasant feeling tone, to push it away, you grab it first. That's the grasping too. You grasp it to push it away. But if you can just watch it, be mindful and observe it, these come and they go, and they come and they go. And you don't grab hold of them. You don't identify with them. Not, you know, identification isn't necessarily intellectual. It's a dynamic. It's an energetic. Pleasant feeling tone comes along. No. Sit still. Don't play with it. Unpleasant feeling tone.
Okay. Stay seated.
And especially like feeling tone gets down to really even an instinctual level. You're already moving before you even are conscious of it sometimes. I did some experiment about, psychological experiment about trying to determine the time between when somebody was had the thought to push a button and pushing the button. And then they did some brain scan on these people. And they found that the brain had already pushed the button before they even were conscious of it, conscious of thinking about pushing the button. Mm. It was something like 0.7 seconds after their brain already pushed the button that they were conscious. I'm going to push that button. So consciousness is already in the past. We're living in the present moment? Yeah, right. Your brain is faster than your awareness. So this is why we can conceptualize and say, oh yes, I'm aware of impermanence, but it's at a very, very deep level. And the Buddha talked about one of the areas of our experience he talked about was literally it's the underlying disposition to conceit, to ego, underlying disposition to it. And it's very, very, you can say it's very primal, then, this instinct for holding on to some permanent entity as an ego. That's why, you know, it takes a little bit of effort to get enlightened. Even though, you know, enlightenment is right here, the truth is right here, there's impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self, right, present all the time, but can you see it? We're unable to see it because our self has obstructed it. But the more you're able to see this obstruction, you begin to let it go, reduce the grasping. It's the process of seeing what you're holding on to. Ajahn Chah gave the analogy, it's like somebody carrying this heavy stone on their back, walking around, and then it's on their back, you see, they can't see it. And somebody says, hey, why are you carrying that stone? What stone? That stone, I don't see any stone. Is it heavy? Heaviness. Oh yeah, I noticed that. Why don't you put that stone down? I never thought of that. Nor who will I be without my stone? You built a whole lifetime being a stone carrier, and if you got to put it down, who are you going to be? Huh? So carrying yourself around, if you happen to let go of yourself, who are you going to be? You might be selfless. Isn't that scary? So close to Halloween. So maybe I better leave time for questions. We still have some time left. Hopefully that was reasonably clear, was it? I mean, my contemplations have been rambling for 2.5 months, so I don't know how consistent they become.
So, Ajahn, what's your prediction about if a book will appear?
Impermanent. There's another little aside to it, because, you know, on one hand it's very simple. Well, there's two asides to it. One is it's in a way it's quite simple, you know, non-self, no substantial essence. But it goes against the grain of most people's understanding and belief, and you know, just saying, you know, non-self. Big question mark arises. People, huh? What are you talking about? You know, I know myself. You know? That's why maybe, like in the Mahayana tradition, they talk about, you know, the greater self, the higher self. Isn't that more inspiring? I like to be a higher self than a no self. And it can be a skillful means to a certain degree, but it's also can be a little tricky, because you don't actually progress to the level of, you know, the impersonal or selflessness. You're still holding on to a subtle self then, which is better than the other one, of course, but still haven't arrived at the final goal, you see. You got a better self, a higher self or something, but it's still a self. So it's going to be subtle suffering anyway. And the second aside is that there isn't actually, the Buddha didn't explain too much about the process. So I've been kind of inclining towards reading more about neuroscience and brain science and psychology and this kind of thing, which sometimes is a bit more clear, other times it, because they don't have the same context, spiritual context, it can become very materialistic. And you know, one book I read more recently just said, you know, we're nothing but brain activity, you know. Well, it's sort of right, yeah, but there's more to it than that, huh? Are you just electrical impulse in your brain? Is that all you are? Huh? So he hasn't taken into context what spirituality is. So, but in the book, he mentions the Buddha, see? And he claims the Buddha came to the same realization as him. So there's a slight difference, because the Buddha got enlightened. Don't think he's claiming enlightenment, but it's the way he put it. He always didn't understand the Buddha's insight, you see. He put it into very simplistic, materialistic, scientific terms, and didn't quite get it. But. There's somebody back there. Are you still have your hand up?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering how it is that we've been around for 100,000 years dealing with change, and yet we're so fixed in fixedness.
Well, I would say maybe it is actually changing a little bit, too. I mean, in the Buddha's time, the Buddha was maybe ahead of his time, I guess. You know, 2,500 years ago, the Buddha had this insight. But the more I read some of these books on science now is also waking up to it. So, they don't come to it by meditation and observing the body-mind, but they come to it indirectly through, you know, they can scan the brain activity, and you know, they're coming at it from another angle. But it seems they're almost coming full circle back to what the Buddha said. And now when it's scientific, I mean, before, to have that, at least have that intellectual knowledge, you had to be a Buddhist. And you had to be a practicing Buddhist. Because not all Buddhists understand that. So you had to be a meditating Buddhist to understand that. So it was quite limited. But now it's coming from a science aspect, which is now being accepted a little bit more universally, and you don't have to adhere to a certain religion. It's becoming common knowledge now. So it's being reinforced or recognized by scientists, and be brought into the popular understanding. But still, most people are still very far behind, even what science is saying. But there is, you know, I think, are we moving into the age of Aquarius or something?
That was the 60s.
We're still going there. It takes a long time, you know, to go into these different constellations. It takes a while. It doesn't happen overnight. like thousands of years or something.
Thank you, Vante. Since you mentioned the Mahayana traditions, in the Mahayana traditions, of course, there's a lot of emphasis on emptiness, whatever sunyata thing is in part is called. So where does that concept fit in the Theravada understanding of it?
Well, there's several kinds of emptiness the Buddha talked about. You know, like one relates to this non-self, it's empty of a permanent abiding essence. And another one was it was a type of meditation practice, a refined meditation practice. It's empty. The Buddha said it's like you go to a forest, and the forest is empty of people. And you go to a desert, it's empty of forest. Mm-hmm. See, normally we do it the other way around. We are looking at things to fill up the space, you see. Mm-hmm. See, but that meditation, you practice the other way around, you start to empty your perceptions and your attitudes of things, you see. So it's developing a certain meditative attitude. It's empty of this and empty of that. For example, most people, they look in this room here and they see the people in the room, the objects in the room. Now, if you empty the room of the people, what do you see?
Space.
Empty space. The empty space is here all the time. But we just look at what's filled it up. But you can change your perception to see the empty space. And actually, the empty space is most of this room. Mm-hmm. The objects filling it up are the minority. I mean, who wants to measure it? You have to believe me. I have this particular volume of cubic centimeters, and you have that much cubic centimeters, and we'll add it all up. So if you change your perceptions, you can. You know, it's like a lightening up of your attitude, or changing it around somehow.
So in that case, the empty of self means empty of permanent self?
That's the main, the fundamental characteristic of the self, is that it's impermanent, permanent essence. And they defined Atman as permanent. So the Buddha was investigating, he couldn't find any permanence in anything. But he did find that there was processes there. It's not like there's nothing.
So if you call that processes as self, then of course you're right.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the processes, they function as, you can say, as a catalyst for people to grab something. Mm-hmm. And when you grab it, if you grab a process, it becomes an object, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, right? but try and grab the wind. The wind is a process, but you try and grab it, you get some air, but you don't get the wind. Try and grab a river. You try and grab the river and you got water, but you haven't got the river. But simple-minded people, they grab the river and they got the water and say, look, I got it. This is what we do with the self. Yeah. Oh, I got it, I'm a self. But you're already, as soon as you say that, you're different. You know? It's flowing, it's completely flowing. Your consciousness, your memories, your feelings are flowing all the time, so you can't get anything. But we keep trying through ignorance conditions, the grasping. We keep clutching, you're clutching at the wind. But we never really got it, but we think we do. All you got is air or water, but you haven't got the river or the wind. But you know, so you haven't really got the self, any self. It's all these constantly changing processes. But it's pretty, you know. How can you use that? You know, you say, I. By the time you get to the end of I, it's already changed. I'm what?
I'm changing.
I'm hunger flowing.
I'm flowing hunger.
So you simplify and say, I feel hungry, or I feel tired. And maybe the moment you say, I feel tired, then it's over. I'm not tired anymore. But then you've identified with, I'm feeling tired, so... Then you start a story up. Oh, I'm feeling tired, so I should lie down. You know, you lie down and I can't sleep because I'm not really tired anymore. It's changed. So, but and that's usually how we live our life. You know, we have these, I'm like this, and so that means I have to do this, this, and this. But hey, wait a minute. If you're in the present moment, a story doesn't really apply anymore. You know, it's an old story, it doesn't apply anymore. You know, I was like this before, you know, but that was, it's a story's finished now, because there's a new story begins right now. You never actually finish any story. It's always a beginning, a new beginning all the time. You know? The present moment is always a beginning. There's no end to it, no ending. Just now.
Maybe related, thinking about the concept of awareness, and you talk about sometimes being aware of or the knowing. How is that kind of, is there, like, how would you maybe discuss a relationship of knowingness or awareness of all these things?
Mm-hmm.
And awareness being there, maybe even a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, in practice, it is a dynamic process. Instead of me knowing something, there is the knowing, which is a constant verb, you see. And we say awareness like it's a thing, it's a noun, isn't it? There is awareness. Where is awareness? What color is it? What shape is it? But there is this process of being aware, being aware. Which is more verb-like, isn't it? I'm not very good in grammar, so...
Awaring,
yes. I even thought to change the English language, like these five groups of grasping, they're mentioned as, like, they're nouns, you say, body. But I was going to change them to, there is no body, there just is embodying. There just is feeling. There just is perceptioning.
Perceiving?
Okay. I've been living overseas too long. There is thinking, and there is consciousness as a kind of knowing. They're all verbs, they're all dynamic processes. Unfortunately, our English language is very noun-orientated. It should be all verbs. In Buddhism, it should be verbs, not nouns, you see. And some languages are, I understand, use more verbs than nouns. I hear, I understand, I don't know, but it's more closer to reality. Yeah. We're just knowing. There just is feeling. And when you begin to observe those processes, you get in tune with it, and you recognize that feeling is not a thing. It's a constantly changing process. Feeling. It's pleasant. It's unpleasant. Neutral. It's pleasant. Unpleasant. Neutral. Where is the feeling I can get my claws into, and say, this is me, this is all my ultimate reality, this pleasant feeling, of course. Unless you're a masochist.
So then it's more, like I think of it sometimes like the first derivative of now, like you did engineering, so instantaneous velocity rather than a fixed function.
Yeah. Rather than fixed, nothing's fixed. You have your hand up here.
Yes, maybe just for my simple mind, I kind of have been thinking, it's kind of putting the conceptual over the empirical, right? That's how we operate in the world. We put the conceptual over the empirical.
Yeah.
The empirical is what is occurring.
Yeah.
And we constantly conceptualize that in order to operate on this level of...
And then we believe the concepts are the thing itself.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We mistake the concepts for the reality and over-empower them. And then we get divorced from or separated from the reality itself, the empirical experience.
Right.
Going back to the subject of consciousness, can we talk about consciousness when we dream?
In Buddhism, we just talk about different kinds of consciousness. There's no such thing as unconscious in Buddhism. Like the psychology, we talk about unconscious, and in Buddhism, there are different kinds of consciousness. So they would say dream consciousness, or waking consciousness, meditation consciousness or something, or rebirth consciousness, or they all modify it. The consciousness, different levels of consciousness, different kinds of consciousness. And even when you're sleeping, there's still consciousness going on, but very, very rudimentary. The Abhidhamma talk about this in the sleep consciousness, they call it a bhavanga. So it's like there is a continuum, a mental continuum going on.
Yeah.
But it's a consciousness, but it's so subtle that most of us aren't aware of it. And dream consciousness, when you understand it that way, if you're studying your consciousness, you can learn a lot from your dreams. And you just say, I was just sleeping, it was just a dream. But it's consciousness speaking too, and if you can read the language of that dream consciousness, you can get a message, you get messages and get some knowledge out of it.
So do you have any suggestions for us in practicing with the khandhas? The how-to manual part of your book?
That's where it got a little bit bogged down. I got bogged down in several points. That was one of them too, because of the language problem primarily, like I just mentioned about, they're mentioned as more like nouns. There is feeling, there is body, there is feeling, there is perception and all these things. But really they are processes. So but our language, English language, is not very processive. It's hard to explain processes in it. So I got a bit bogged down with, first of all, you have to know what they are. So you have to define them, just like I mentioned yesterday about feeling tone, When it's translated into English, feeling, most people just go off into emotion. And it's not what the Buddha was, he talked about feeling tone, only pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. There's a few more refinements of that. There's bodily feeling and mental feeling, but keep it simple. But just the English language, we don't have that word. I mean, if I use that word in Thailand, Vedana, most Thais know it. They don't, and then emotion is arom, different word for emotion. But in English, you don't have that clear distinction, you see. So that's why you get a bit confused. And the same with perception is not actually right for sanya. Sa-jnana, it's a knowledge. Jnana is a knowledge, and sa means associative knowledge, which implies the memory. But perception is more closer to what we would say is consciousness, that you perceive. There's something there, you see. But the sanyana, sa-jnana, is the associated knowledge, and vijnana is the distinguishing knowledge. So there's sight, sound, smell, taste, touch happening, but where your attention goes distinguishes up. There's a sound. And then there's a feeling with it. Is it dangerous, or should I run, or should I stay here? Pleasant or unpleasant? At a primal level. And then there's sanya, says there's something there, it's a sound. That sounds like a dog barking. And then maybe the thinking comes in then. Oh, a dog barking. It reminds me of my old dog I had in the blah, 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 blah. Oops. That was just a sound, right? But I'm way off in some kind of fantasy realm building a story about it. And it's just a sound. Back to reality again. It wasn't your dog. It was just a sound. That's the only thing you can really be sure about. It's just a sound. And then we put all the other stuff onto it. And maybe the sanya sometimes is distorted. There's misperceptions. You hear a sound and think, oh, it's a dog. No. It was like a Birkin, those coyotes. And they keep thinking, somebody's screaming. No, it's a coyote. It sounds like somebody out there getting strangled. No, it's the coyote. You hope. You might misperceive, and then Ajahn Sonu doesn't come up appear the next morning and he's been strangled. But misperception is very common too.
Yeah. So could we choose something, to actually practice, intentionally practice with it, so to use something through one of our sense doors, like sound or sight or... Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're developing the exercises in mindfulness, I mean, you have already the first exercise is the body. You get a sense for the body and how it is actually embodying and not a thing you're watching. But you open up to noticing it's changing all the time. There is, it's light, it's heavy, it's cold, it's hot, it's, it feels compacted or relaxed and open. And so you can notice the change in that one of these five groups of grasping, one of them anyway. And then feeling tone I introduced yesterday. I don't know if it's you understand it enough to be able to use it to contemplate. But you can say ideally you only need to observe the change in one of them, not all five. I mean, ideally. If you can really see the change, you can really see impermanence, imperfection, and impersonality in the body, you're enlightened. But some of us have other attachments, to memory and to thinking, So maybe you can, you have a certain level of insight into the impermanence of the body, but if you have a strong identification with thinking, then that's still going on identification to grasp onto that, so you don't know the impermanence of the thinking yet. But you can see it in regard to the body to a certain degree, but not thinking yet. So you have a subtle thinking self.
Or not so subtle.
You're not so, yeah. You say, oh yes, I'm not my body, but I like thinking though. So it's kind of, generally, it's helpful to spread your options, you see, around all five. See? So maybe some of them are clearer to you than others, I mean, I still kind of struggle with consciousness, you know, because it's the kind of big one, you see. And there's an incredible range of consciousness, because in developing concentration exercises, you're actually raising the level of consciousness, so it gets more and more refined until there's one kind of consciousness mentioned in scriptures called non-manifesting consciousness. What's that? Maybe I should leave that for the for your homework. So it's nearly 9 o'clock.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for sharing with us.
And I wish you all the best in your practice, and see you in Nibbana.